A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
June 19th, 2026. Zohran Mamdani, the progressive state assembly member leading in the New York City mayoral polls, is at a rally. He calls AIPAC monsters. Not lobbyists, not political opponents, not even a problematic organization. And here's the thing. Jewish New Yorkers heard that word differently than the rest of the room. They heard centuries of a very specific rhetorical move, the one where Jewish influence is framed as something inhuman, something lurking.
What's striking is the timing. This isn't a fringe candidate shouting from the sidewalk. Mamdani is the Democratic frontrunner. The JTA reported on this the same day, June 19th, and the condemnation from the ADL, the AJC, UJA Federation was immediate and unified. But the question hanging over all of it is, does the condemnation matter if he's still winning?
That's the collision I can't stop thinking about. New York has been the anchor of American Jewish life for nearly four centuries. 23 refugees from Recife, Brazil, landed in New Amsterdam in 1654 and started something that would become the most significant Jewish diaspora community in the modern world.
370 years. That's the arc we're talking about. From 23 Sephardic refugees stepping off a boat in 1654 to 1.6 million Jews living in the five boroughs today. It's not just the one word.
The question underneath Daniel's question, the one Herman flagged when we were talking about this, is whether we're watching a genuine inflection point. Not just another rough patch, but the kind of moment historians will look back on and say, that's when the long goodbye began.
Which is why we need to trace the whole thing. From Peter Stuyvesant trying to expel those first 23 refugees through the tenements of the Lower East Side, through the post-war peak of 2.2 million Jews, right up to a mayor using a word like monsters and Jewish families quietly googling nefesh benefesh.
That's what we're going to do. 370 years of Jewish New York and one very uncomfortable question about its future. Before we go back to 1654, let's sit with what Adams actually said and why it landed the way it did. Because this wasn't a single slip. Back in March, at the 1654, here's the thing about turning points. You rarely recognize them when you're inside them. The 23 Jews who landed in New Amsterdam in 1654 had no idea they were founding anything. They were refugees from a failed Dutch colony in Brazil, fleeing the Portuguese Inquisition. Governor Peter Stuyvesant tried to expel them immediately, called them deceitful and very repugnant. The Dutch West India Company overruled him.
The thing about the St. Patrick's Day breakfast remark, it wasn't just the word genocide, it was the venue. Which is why we need to trace the whole arc. Because if you don't understand how Jewish New York was built, the waves of immigration, the crises, the reinventions, you can't evaluate whether this current moment is genuinely different or just another chapter in a long history of tension.
That's what we're going to do. Start in 1654. Move through the German wave, the Eastern European explosion that created the Lower East Side of popular imagination, the post-war suburbanization, the Russian revival of the 90s.
The communal response was unusually sharp. And I want to be specific about this because it matters. The JCRC of New York, that's the Jewish Community Relations Council, they don't do hot takes. They're the establishment, the bridge builders. The stakes are enormous. New York's Jewish population is roughly 1.5 million people. That's larger than Tel Aviv, larger than Haifa. If even a fraction of that community reconsiders its place, whether through aliyah, or moving to the suburbs, or just disengaging from civic life, it reshapes both New York and Israel. And the aliyah numbers are already moving.
The more telling signal, and I think this is what Daniel's really pointing at, is the behavioral shift. It's not just statements. Daniel's question lands at exactly the right moment. Let's get into it.
Before we go back to 1654, I want to sit with the Mamdani moment for one more beat, because there's a detail here that matters for understanding why this feels different from previous political fights. Eric Adams, the outgoing mayor, a Democrat, not some Republican from across the aisle, signed an anti-BDS executive order in his final weeks in office. He's been a staunch Israel supporter his entire tenure. So the shift from Adams to Mamdani isn't a normal partisan swing. It's a realignment within the Democratic Party itself, in the city that houses more Jews than any other outside Israel.
That's the shift. That's what makes this different from previous moments of tension. New York Jews have dealt with anti-Semitism from the outside, from street violence, from fringe movements, from the occasional public figure. That's what I mean about the word monsters. If this were just campaign rhetoric, if it were just one candidate saying something overheated, the institutional Jewish world would issue its statements and move on. But Mamdani is leading.
It's not just the words. It's the pattern of what he doesn't say. Since October 7th, 2023, there have been protests in New York that explicitly target synagogues, Jewish-owned businesses, kosher restaurants, using Zionist as a stand-in for Jew. The NYPD Hate Crimes Task Force reports anti-Semitic incidents up 140%, and Adams has consistently declined to characterize these as anti-Semitic. He frames them as legitimate political speech.
Which is the blind eye Herman mentioned. When a Molotov cocktail gets thrown at a Borough Park yeshiva at 2 in the morning, and the mayor's office issues a statement but doesn't visit the scene, people notice. When Columbia University sets up encampments that literally bar Zionists from entering certain spaces, and the administration equivocates, and the mayor doesn't push back, people notice.
The word monsters has a specific history. It's not random. It's the language of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, of Nazi propaganda, of Soviet anti-Zionist campaigns that painted Jews as a conspiratorial force manipulating world events. You don't accidentally reach for that word. It sits in a specific rhetorical tradition, and Adams is too canny a politician not to know that.
The question becomes, is this a turning point? And I think you can't answer that without understanding what it would mean to actually leave. Which is where the history matters. Because Jewish New York isn't just a population statistic. It's 370 years of institutions, cemeteries, synagogues, businesses, philanthropic networks, cultural memory. Leaving isn't like switching cell phone plans. It's severing roots that go deeper than anywhere else in the diaspora.
That's not a policy disagreement. That's an existential challenge to your place in the political community you helped build. It's about whether the social contract that made Jewish New York possible is still intact. Before we plunge into 1654, let me name the three layers we're actually tracking here. Because this episode could easily sprawl into a 10-part series, and we need to be disciplined about what we're doing. Layer 1 is the 370-year arc, the full sweep from those 23 refugees to the 1.5 million Jews in the metro area today. You can't assess whether this moment is unprecedented unless you know what came before.
Which is where I get to nap through the historical parts while you do the heavy lifting. And the first thing that happens is Peter Stuyvesant, the governor, writes to his bosses at the Dutch West India Company in Amsterdam and says, essentially, get these people out of my colony. He called them a deceitful race and said they'd infect the place.
Stuyvesant was a piece of work. He was a Dutch Reformed Calvinist, one leg, famously ornery, and he had a particular animus toward Jews, Catholics, Quakers, basically anyone who wasn't Dutch Reformed. But here's the twist that matters. The Dutch West India Company overruled him, not because they were enlightened pluralists, because Jewish shareholders in Amsterdam had put serious money into the company, and the company needed settlers. Tolerance was a business decision.
The first Jewish New Yorkers got to stay because some guys in Amsterdam looked at a balance sheet. That's the origin story. It's not inspiring, but it's honest. And it sets a pattern that runs through the whole history. Jewish acceptance in New York has almost never been about principle. It's been conditional, transactional, negotiated.
It worked, barely. By 1730, there was a synagogue, Sherith Israel, the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue, which still exists today. It's on West 70th Street now, but its congregation is the oldest in continuous operation in the United States. Those 23 refugees and their descendants built the first Jewish institution in North America.
The history tells us what's happened before, when Jewish New York faced existential pressure. The present tells us what's happening now, and the demographic data tells us whether the response is flight, fight, or something in between. The German Jews came from a different world, more educated, more acculturated, and they arrived with ambition. Families like the Strausses, who bought Macy's, the Guggenheims, who built a mining and then an art empire, the Lehmans, who founded one of the most powerful investment banks in American history.
They built the institutional skeleton of Jewish New York. B'nai B'rith was founded in 1843 on the Lower East Side. Mount Sinai Hospital opened in 1852, explicitly because Jewish doctors couldn't get admitting privileges at the existing hospitals. I should say up front, we're not going to pretend we know the answer. History doesn't give you clean predictions, but it does give you patterns, and it does give you the questions that are worth asking. That's what we're after.
Then let's stop previewing and start at the beginning. 1654, 23 Jews, and a governor who wanted them gone. The German Jews had worked hard to assimilate, to become respectable New Yorkers, and here came 2 million people who seemed determined to undo all of it.
When the Portuguese took over, the Inquisition followed, and Jews who'd been living openly under Dutch rule had about 3 choices: convert, hide, or flee. These 23 fled. They poured into the Lower East Side until it became the most densely populated place on the planet, 350,000 people per square mile. To put that in perspective, Manhattan today is about 70,000 per square mile. The Lower East Side was 5 times as dense.
Out of that compression came an explosion. Yiddish theater on 2nd Avenue. The Forward newspaper with a circulation in the hundreds of thousands. The Garment District Unions. The whole texture of what people think of when they think of old Jewish New York. Which is almost funny in retrospect, given that New York would become the most religiously plural city on earth. But the Dutch West India Company's response is the part that matters. They overruled him in 1655.
The 1909 shirtwaist strike is the moment that crystallizes this. 20,000 garment workers, mostly Jewish women, some as young as 16, walked out. That last clause is the template. Let them stay, but they're on their own. It's the first articulation of what would become the American Jewish bargain. You can be here, but don't expect the state to protect you when things get difficult. You build your own institutions, you fund your own poor, you handle your own security.
That's exactly what they did. By 1656, they'd established a cemetery, the first Jewish institution in North America, because you need somewhere to bury your dead before you need a synagogue. By the 1730s, they'd built Shirath Israel, the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue, which still exists today on the Upper West Side. 290 years of continuous operation.
That's the founding template. Now fast forward to 1820. New York has maybe 500 Jews total. A small, mostly Sephardi community, well integrated into merchant life, and then the German wave hits. The move to the outer boroughs, the Grand Concourse in the Bronx, Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn, and then out to Long Island, Westchester, Rockland County. About 150,000, they came from Bavaria, from Prussia, from the Rhineland, places where legal restrictions on Jewish life were being lifted, but social and economic barriers remained.
Then the slow decline. Today it's about 1.6 million Jews in the city. They didn't just build businesses. They built the institutional skeleton of American Judaism. The secular and liberal Jewish New York that dominated the 20th century is shrinking.
The German Jews essentially invented Reform Judaism in America. They wanted a Judaism that looked respectable to their Protestant neighbors, organs, sermons in English, decorum in the pews. The mostly Jewish teachers' union, the UFT, saw it as a threat to due process and professional standards. The strike dragged on for months, the rhetoric got vicious, and by the end, there was a rupture between black and Jewish communities that had been allies through the civil rights movement. It never fully healed.
That's the thing about Jewish New York's history. It's not a straight line of progress. It's waves of arrival and waves of tension, institutions built and institutions tested, a constant negotiation over whether Jews belong here and on what terms. Stuyvesant tried to expel them. The German Jews tried to reform them. The garment unions radicalized them. The suburbs dispersed them. And now a mayor is calling them monsters.
The question is, what makes this moment different from the crises that came before? And I think there are 2 answers. The first is what you just said, the mayor is the source. That's genuinely new. But the second is the way the language has shifted. The assassination of Tsar Alexander II in 1881 triggered a wave of pogroms and anti-Jewish laws across the Russian Empire. The Pale of Settlement. The territory in what's now Poland, Lithuania, Belarus, Ukraine, Moldova, where Jews were legally confined, became a pressure cooker.
And I think it's worth being precise about what that actually looks like on the ground. It's not abstract. In June of this year, Columbia University had encampments that literally barred Zionists from entering certain spaces. In 43 years. That's not immigration, that's a population transfer.
They packed into the Lower East Side at densities that are still hard to comprehend. By 1900, the 10th Ward, about 3/4 of a square mile, had 350,000 people per square mile. That's the highest population density ever recorded anywhere on Earth, before or since.
I've seen those photographs. The tenements, the pushcarts, the fire escapes draped with bedding. What was daily life actually like? He didn't go to Borough Park. He didn't stand in front of the yeshiva with the community. He issued a statement and moved on.
The Forward newspaper printing 250,000 copies a day. The garment unions organizing strikes that shut down entire industries. The cafes on East Broadway where poets and revolutionaries argued socialism versus Zionism until 4 in the morning.
The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in 1911. That was the Lower East Side, right? And the applicant profile tells you everything. It's not the kids from the Zionist youth movements. It's secular professionals, 30s and 40s, dual incomes, young children. People who say, I don't want my kid to be the only Jew in the classroom when the teacher puts on a map that doesn't include Israel and the class discussion turns into a trial.
Jewish organizers like Clara Lemlich and Rose Schneiderman, 18 years old, speaking at Cooper Union saying, I would be a traitor to those poor burned bodies if I came here to talk good fellowship. Aliyah for them is a disruption, a financial hit, a professional downgrade in many cases. You don't make that calculation unless the push factors have become overwhelming.
The question is whether this is a real trend or just noise. 300% sounds dramatic, but 300% of what? If the baseline was 100 applications a year, we're talking 300. If it was 1,000, we're talking 3,000. That matters for understanding the scale.
By the 1950s, New York's Jewish population peaked at roughly 2 million. But it was now a suburban population, organized around synagogues and community centers rather than tenement blocks and union halls. There's a quieter trend of families moving to Florida, to Texas, to places where they feel the political environment is less hostile. That's harder to track, but the real estate agents in Boca Raton and Dallas know what's happening.
The economic dimension is the part nobody in City Hall seems to be thinking about. Jewish philanthropy in New York is not a rounding error. The UJA Federation alone moves hundreds of millions of dollars a year into social services, not just for Jews, for the whole city. That was a turning point for a different reason than what we're seeing now. The threat wasn't from political leadership, it was from a breakdown in inter-community trust.
It's not just the big names, it's the small donors. The synagogue building funds, the local JCCs, the kosher restaurants, the Jewish day schools that employ thousands of people. Jewish New York is an economic ecosystem. Crown Heights in 1991 was the next inflection point. 3 days of anti-Jewish violence after a car in the Lubavitcher Rebbe's motorcade hit and killed a black child.
The flip side, and I think we have to be honest about this, is that leaving is not easy. It's not just selling an apartment. It's abandoning cemeteries where your grandparents are buried. It's walking away from a synagogue your family helped build. That moment radicalized a generation of Orthodox Jews politically. They've been reliable Democrats. After Crown Heights, they started voting Republican in larger numbers, organizing as a bloc, demanding more from City Hall.
Which is what makes the Adams moment so strange, strategically. This is a mayor who has Jewish staffers, who's been to Israel, who's spoken at Jewish events. He's not David Duke. He knows the community. We've seen ruptures before. But here's what makes the current moment different, and this gets us back to Mamdani. In 1991, the mayor wasn't the one using hostile rhetoric. Dinkins was criticized for inaction, not for stoking the fire.
Say more about that.
Adams is looking at the Democratic Party and seeing that anti-Israel sentiment has become a litmus test for the progressive left. AIPAC is the symbol of pro-Israel political engagement. Calling them monsters is a way of signaling to that flank, I'm with you. And he's betting that Jewish voters have nowhere else to go. That they'll hold their noses and vote for him anyway because the alternative is someone further left who might be worse.
It's the old political calculus. Make your base feel taken for granted and see if they flinch. The problem is that for the first time in living memory, they might actually flinch. Not by voting Republican necessarily, but by leaving. The real estate data tells its own story. In 2025, the number of New York City apartments sold to buyers with Israeli addresses doubled from 2023. That's not a feeling. That's people wiring money and signing deeds.
Let's talk about the Alia numbers directly, because this is where the analysis gets nuanced. 5,000 Americans made Alia in 2025, the highest since 1970. New York accounts for about 40%. That's roughly 2,000 New Yorkers. Out of 1.5 million, that's 0.13%.
By the raw numbers, it's a trickle. And I want to be careful not to oversell this. We're not watching a mass exodus. But the composition matters more than the volume. Nefesh B'Nefesh, which handles North American Aliyah, says the people who are moving are disproportionately young professionals, families with children, people who are institutionally active. These are exactly the people who would be the next generation of community leaders if they stayed. Where does this leave us? If you're a Jewish New Yorker listening to this, or someone who cares about the future of the city, here's what I think you need to be paying attention to. The decision to stay or leave isn't really about whether anti-Semitism exists in New York. It always has. Stuyvesant tried to expel the first 23. Coughlin's Christian Front beat Jews in the streets. Crown Heights happened. The question is whether the city's leadership takes it seriously.
That's the social contract question. Jewish New York has always been a negotiation, right? We traced that whole history. Acceptance was conditional, transactional, never fully secure. That's what the history tells us to watch for. Jewish communities don't usually disappear overnight. They hollow out first.
For non-Jewish New Yorkers listening to this, I think it's worth understanding that a Jewish exodus wouldn't be a victimless event. We're not just talking about population statistics. Jewish philanthropy in this city moves billions. The question isn't whether 2,000 people made Alia. The question is whether 2,000 is the leading edge of something larger, or whether it's a spike that will revert once the political cycle turns.
That depends on what happens in the next 18 months. If Mamdani wins, and if the protest culture continues or intensifies, and if Jewish institutions keep feeling like they're on their own, then 10,000 per year starts to look plausible. If he loses, or if the rhetoric moderates once he's in office and has to govern, maybe the numbers flatten.
The wild card is that Jewish New York has remade itself before. Every wave we talked about, the German Jews, the Eastern Europeans, the Russians, each one arrived during or after a crisis and rebuilt the community in its own image. The Orthodox are growing. The Israeli expat community is growing. The community that emerges from this moment might be smaller but more consolidated, more religious, more Hebrew-speaking, more explicitly Zionist.
Which would be a profound transformation. The Jewish New York that dominated American culture for the 20th century, secular, liberal, English-speaking, deeply invested in the American project, that version might be the one that shrinks. And what replaces it looks more like the rest of the Jewish world, orthodox, traditional, with one foot in Israel. But the most important action is political, making clear to your elected officials that anti-Semitism is a red line, not a negotiating point.
The Orthodox communities in Brooklyn are responding differently from secular Jews on the Upper West Side, and younger Jews are more likely to consider leaving than their parents. That's not a monolith. But the direction of travel is the same across the board. People are asking the question, and that question itself is the story.
Let me leave you with one final thought, and it's not a comfortable one. We've spent this episode tracing 370 years of Jewish New York. Where does this leave us? Let me offer three scenarios for Jewish New York in 2030, because I think the range of plausible outcomes is wider than most people assume. The community shrinks, but consolidates. Fewer Jews overall, maybe 1.2 million instead of 1.5, but the ones who remain are more committed, more institutionally engaged, more likely to be Orthodox or Israeli identified.
The fact that the question is even being asked, that the mayor of New York City has made Jewish New Yorkers feel like strangers in their own city, that's itself a historic shift, which has actually been the pattern in a lot of diaspora communities that face pressure. The people who stay are the ones for whom Jewish identity is non-negotiable. Everyone else drifts. When your grandparents built a synagogue in 1730, and their descendants are now Googling how to get an Israeli passport, something has broken.
Even without Mamdani, the demographics are pushing toward consolidation. Political counter-mobilization. This is the Crown Heights playbook. After 1991, Jews who'd been politically diffuse got organized.
Will the Adams era be remembered as a turning point, the moment the long goodbye began, or as a stress test that the city's pluralism ultimately passed? We don't know. The story isn't over. But you're living through the chapter that future historians will argue about. That's worth sitting with.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early medieval period, sailors off the coast of Djibouti reported a species of cuttlefish capable of mimicking not just color and texture, but the precise flickering light patterns of bioluminescent plankton. The species was never formally catalogued and was presumed extinct until a French marine expedition in 1998 captured 47 seconds of footage matching the medieval descriptions exactly. No specimen has ever been recovered.
47 seconds of footage, and then it vanished again. That's the most on-brand thing I've ever heard for a cuttlefish.
The Aliyah wave accelerates. If Mamdani wins, if the protest culture intensifies, if Jewish institutions keep feeling besieged, 10,000 North American alim per year becomes plausible, and New York would supply a disproportionate share.
I'm Korn. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.